Excuse me. I'd like to remind all participants this conference is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this time. You may begin.
Thank you. Good morning, good afternoon, good evening. Welcome to the IGO-INGO-PDP Working Group call on Wednesday, 20th March, 2013. On the call today, we have Jim Bykoff, Avery Doria, Chuck Gomes, Alan Greenberg, Catherine Gribben, Stefan Hankins, David Maher, Osvaldo Novoa, Christopher Rassi, and Thomas Wickett. We have apologies from Greg Chatton, Wolfgang Kleinwaster, Ricardo Gillum, Landry Ajayi, Kiden Fournet, and Deborah Hughes. And from staff, we have Mariko Cunnings, who will be joining later, Barry Cobb, Brian Peck, and Samantha Eisner, and myself, Julia Chauvelin. May I remind all participants to please state their names before speaking for transcription purposes. Thank you very much, and over to you.
Thank you very much, Julia. This is Thomas Rickert speaking, and I'm chairing this PDP working group. And before we go to the next agenda item, I'd like to ask the group whether there are any updates to statements of interest. Hearing and reading none, we can now move to the second agenda item, which is the review of the General Counsel Research Survey response. And at this point, I'd like to thank Samantha Eisner for joining today's call and being available to answer our questions. And also, I'd like to thank you, Sam, and your colleagues for providing the response to our request to General Counsel in the first place. As you will have heard from Brian Peck, who I guess is the person that you have liaised with, we have already talked about the response during last week's call, and we've also taken note of some questions from the group, and I'm not sure whether Brian has already conveyed these questions to you, but I'd like to ask you, Brian, maybe to read out the questions for the group and then ask Samantha to respond to them.
Sure. Thanks, Thomas. Sam and I did have a chance to meet before this call to go over a couple of the key questions that were raised last week in the group during discussion, the review of the response to the General Counsel's office. So I guess, I mean, if it's easiest as you propose, I just go ahead and maybe reiterate those questions, and Sam can respond, and then we can, I guess, open up to any other additional questions if that would be okay.
That would be perfect. Thank you, Brian.
Okay. I think one of the questions was whether, you know, out of the research from the report, if there was indeed established a separate level of liability, if you will, in terms of possible infringement or of right holders, compared to what are the general rights that right holders have to their name if it were to be registered by a third party.
So this is Sam Eisner, and thank you for having me, and thank you for your patience as we've been working through the research here, and I'm happy to be able to be here today, and if you have follow-on questions throughout this process, be sure to let Brian know so I can come back and join you at later times. In regards to the question regarding whether it's liability generally or more specifically, so, you know, as we work through the questions, if you review the question that was sent to us, which is posted in the notes section of the Adobe Connect, the issue of liability really wasn't a part of the question that was posed to us for this. However, as we went through the research and determined that there really were very few, if any, statutes that specifically mention the role of ICANN, a registry or a registrar, in relation to the registrations, we then tried to look a little bit more broadly to see if the laws and treaties and protections that did exist in regards to these specific types of names that the Red Cross and the IOC for being the most prominent INGOs as well as the IGOs, if there seemed to be anything special that would attach specifically to registries or registrars based on allowing registrations to go through with this. So we really tried to have this research. We weren't looking at, is there a potential for general liability? That has been well tried by multiple people in many places around the ICANN world. And this was looking more specifically at how liability may go up the value chain as you are undertaking these registrations. So as we noted in the executive summary on the research performed, that we didn't provide a detailed assessment of how likely liability would be to a registry or registrar in any specific instance, because really across the jurisdictions, we found that each one had much different ideas about accessory types of liability and the types of ways that they might look into a registrant relationship or a registrar relationship for the imposition of liability.
Thomas, are there any follow-up questions to Sam's response or related to this issue? Or?
Well, I'd like to open it up to the group whether there are any follow-up questions. Brian, was this the only question that we have noted during last week's call?
No, there was also the – sorry, I understand. Let me get closer to the mic. I apologize for that. There was also the question raised as whether there were other INGOs that were researched in addition to the IOC and the Red Cross, Red Crescent. And, you know, if not, if there's a possibility of maybe perhaps looking at that.
If you'd like, Thomas, I can respond to that now.
That would be excellent. Thank you, Sam.
Great. So we did not conduct specific research outside of the IOC and the Red Cross on the INGO side. Part of that was based on the research that had been performed previously as the issue of protections was being developed within the new GTLD program. That was the research that you guys have seen that was previously produced in unredacted form a few months ago. Throughout that research, really, it stood out that the IOC and the Red Cross stood in a different position than many other organizations out there, and so those were the most likely on the INGO side to have protections. We know, and I understand it's been part of the challenge to this group as well, coming up with a standard definition across jurisdictions about what an INGO is and how each jurisdiction would recognize that. It is a very difficult and time-consuming process, and so we used the benefit of our previous research to identify that that the IOC and the Red Cross were the ones that we were most likely to have any potential to really identify whether or not heightened protections exist. As you see from the research that we presented, to the extent that other INGOs called out and there were statutes that related to registration of domain names, we have those identified. And again, that is only in one place. That's for Brazil and the protections that are afforded to FIFA. And then also, I know that there are some protections that we had not identified yet in Mexico that Brian forwarded to me, and we'll have that updated for you within the memo. We'll get an updated version out. In terms of the feasibility of performing additional research, I think that this is where we would really get into the laws of diminishing returns. I think the amount of time and effort that it would take to come up with some sort of definition that we could even guide our attorneys across jurisdictions to perform research over and then have any hope of getting something back from them about it, I really question, first of all, the amount of time it would take for them to come back on something that's far more ambiguous than what they've already looked into, and we see how long that's taken already. I don't really have much confidence that that would return a lot more information.
Empty, please.
Glenn, what was that? I thought I had heard Glenn Ford. Sam, please continue, sorry.
So that really is, that's basically the sum of the answer to that. I'd be happy to entertain further questions about that issue.
Well, Samantha, I think the issue before I move to Alan, for the INGO representative in particular, was that INGOs have not been mentioned in the study. They also confirmed that the fact that you may not have been able to find positive results confirming protection that you have been looking for has not been particularly surprising to them. But still, I guess they would appreciate at least a small note that you have not been able to identify anything for INGOs. I'm sure that the INGO representatives will chime in as we move along, but I guess that was just a point to, number one, find out whether you've done something in that area, and number two, to formally, if you wish, have the INGOs included in the findings, and if it's only to the extent saying that you haven't found anything. Alan, please.
Yeah, thank you. I was intrigued by the statement that it is possible that a registry going, as you used the expression, going up the food chain, a registrar or registry could incur some liability if they register some specific name in some jurisdiction. I understand that registries can essentially create their own list of names that they will not register. What about registrars? Is there anything in the agreements registrars sign that requires them to register a name if it's available, or can a registrar in some jurisdiction say, I will not register this list of names due to local law? Is that allowed by the RAA and associated documents, forbidden, or is silent?
Just speaking off the top of my head, and I am very familiar with the RAA, you know, there's nothing within the RAA that appears to either expressly require the registrar to register all names that a customer would present to it for registration, because the registrar actually has an affirmative obligation to follow all applicable laws, and then the registry or the registration agreement that the registrar would enter into with its registrants also requires that the registrant take on the responsibility that their registration is being undertaken in conformity with applicable laws. So I think with that, far from having an explicit requirement from the registrar to undertake registration of all requested names, the registrar has the ability to identify whether or not a registration would be undertaken in violation of the laws applicable to that registrar. So while there's not anything explicitly written about the registrar's ability to create its own reserve names list or anything like that,
it's not forbidden either.
It's not, exactly.
Okay. Now, I was just wondering if we ended up with a catch-22 that, you know, a registrar could be in a position where they couldn't do something, but they weren't allowed not to do it. So
that's
a good answer.
Yeah, far from it. The registrar is obligated to follow its applicable laws. So to the extent the registrar believes the laws under which it operates forbid certain registrations, it would be up to the registrar to not undertake those registrations.
Okay, thank you.
Aubrey, please.
Yeah, hi, this is Aubrey. A quick question, and the answer to this may be, you know, may vary jurisdictionally. Given that they have this requirement to adhere to their national and local laws about registrations, is there any obligation on anyone else to make sure that they know what those laws are and how they relate to various classes of word? Thanks.
So I think that this is really where we go back to some of the more general expectations that exist throughout the registration value chain, right? So the registrant itself has an obligation to not undertake registrations that are in violation of law or infringe on the rights of others, and that the expectation that people are aware of the effect of the actions that they're undertaking is just part of the registration chain today. So I'm not sure that there's, there's nothing written, Avery, that states it in the way that you express the question, but the expectation that people understand the laws under which they are undertaking registrations, particularly, again, this is jurisdictionally specific, but that people understand the laws under which they're operating any part of their business or any part of their day-to-day lives, that's an obligation that exists already.
Okay, thanks. So just to make sure I understand, because I'm being slow. So the registrar should also know that in their country, for example, various classes of names should not be registered, and they should have their own mechanisms for determining what their country allows and doesn't allow. That's something that we could all expect them to be doing.
Yes, in the most general sense, registrars and any other business are expected to understand the laws under which they operate. So to the extent that goes to names that are given special protection within the countries that they operate, or it could be something that doesn't even have to do with the registration of names, right? It runs the whole gamut. But yes, that is an expectation that we have of all businesses with which we do business.
Thank you.
Are there more questions for Samantha? At the moment, I don't see any hands, which is why I'm taking the opportunity to ask a question myself. Samantha, we have, phrased the question to General Counsel the way we did because we wanted to find out whether there were any reasons for granting special protections to certain types of organizations. When I read your report, I more or less get the impression that when you made reference to liability, that the liability risk for registries and registrars would not be special for the organizations that we're discussing, but that would be general liability risk, particularly, let's say, in instances where a registrar is made available, aware of and given actual knowledge of an infringement. And that, if the registrar doesn't act upon it, that ultimately that might result in liability. But I did not understand the way you phrased your response as any special or extra liability risk being present if third party illegitimately tries to register the name of the organizations in question. Is my understanding correct in that sense?
In typical lawyer fashion, I will say yes and no. What the research showed was that there are special classes. In many jurisdictions, there are special classes of names. I think we need to separate out the Red Cross and IOC from the general IGO question. So on the IGO side, we looked specifically to see if there was any heightened protections by virtue of being on the Sixter list. And so I think that to the extent that there's that the countries afford protection and specifically call out certain rights to IGOs, be they rights that the IGOs themselves have had to provide notice to or get onto a registered list, that it can be more, it appears that it could be more likely for general or for someone to seek liability or seek to impose liability against a registry or a registrar when those names are of that heightened protection and not just given a general protection that you'd have for other trademark classes or generally infringing registrations, whether or not the likelihood of that liability imposing is different based on if it's a general registration or one of these names. We didn't parse through that too much because we actually didn't look at general trademark or general infringement areas. But in some ways, that risk calculus probably could be the same, but there's likely more notice ability to a registry or registrar based on the fact that the organization's an IGO or is on a special list somewhere. In terms of the Red Cross and the IOC marks, clearly, which the marks that are protected across jurisdictions depend on the specific location and the specific words and marks that are associated in those regions. But there, because of the, there seems to be more universality of protections across the board that those likely would be of a far more potential to raise issues at any point in the value chain, be it registrant, registry, or registrar.
Thanks. That's very helpful. A quick follow-up question, though. At least in the jurisdiction that I'm living in, there would be a risk for, let's say players in the market. Let's keep it that broadly.
Okay.
If they don't take action after having obtained actual knowledge of an infringement taking place, and I understood your analysis to speak of liability risk more in that area. The big challenge for this working group to cope with, and we still haven't resolved there, is that the four types of organizations that we're discussing, IOC, RC, IGOs, and INGOs, are asking for preventative protections. While in, at least, in the jurisdiction that I'm in, I would be able to spot curative protection mechanisms. So if an unlawful registration has taken place, then certainly you would have a stick to beat the registrant with, and possibly the registrar as well. But the question to us, and that would facilitate our work enormously, is if you could identify reasons within the laws that would justify or not justify preventative protection mechanisms, i.e. whether there is a legal obligation for registries and registrars to prevent illegitimate third-party registrations from taking place.
It's definitely a difficult line to walk, and I understand that the hard questions that this drafting team is looking at. I think I can tell from the way that the questions were asked that, really it's clear that there was some view of whether or not there could be some bright line drawn for preventative protections. One of the issues is that it's not uniform across jurisdictions whether or not or to what extent knowledge is a requirement, and so then it would trigger curative issues as opposed to preventative issues. It's really hard to come up with a bright line rule that is based on the laws that could be more broadly applicable. We hope that the research we provided helps show where there are considerations of more universal type of protections, and so the more universal that their protections appear to be, even though there might be different classes or different member state associations within those, the more universal they come out, and this is me speaking as Samantha Eisner, not me speaking as a member of the Office of the General Counsel, really, this is something that I would say leans more towards the ability to try to create some sort of preventative scope or some categories that you could provide preventative registrations or preventative protections within. But, you know, it's really hard, and I'm not sure where we would take the research in order to provide that. One of the things we found is that it's just so varying that it's hard for us to help you create that. And so we're trying to give you information within which you can help define if there are areas of preventative protections, but I don't know what else we could give to you. If you have ideas of what that could be, we could take a look at it and see if that's something else we can provide to you. But I'm off the top of my head, I can't quite figure out where that would go.
Who's that, please?
This is Claudia. May I get in the queue, Thomas?
Yes, you can. Ellen is first.
Okay, just a quick comment that one of the difficulties we're facing, at least some of us are facing, is the belief that even if there is legislation preventing use of some terms, there are almost always exceptions, whether it's prior use or what use you're going to be making of it or fair use rules that, you know, such that criticism is allowed. And one of the difficulties we're facing is how to do this on a global scale but still not remove the rights that people have to use some of these terms due to the specific way in which they're going to be used. So thank you.
Thomas,
yeah, Stefan
Hankins,
I'd
like to get in the queue,
please,
if I may.
Yes, you are in the queue. Samantha, would you like to respond? No problem. Samantha, would you like to comment or respond to Alan's intervention?
I wasn't really expecting a response, but Sam certainly may if she chooses.
No, I just wanted to give her the opportunity to do
yeah.
so.
It is something that's definitely hard to respond to, and I definitely appreciate the boundaries within which you're trying to do your work, and I don't know if there are middle ground solutions that can also be come to, you know, but, you know, is there some sort of approval right or something, you know, the way that jurisdictions could resolve those sorts of prior rights abilities, can they you know, can some of that be brought into the work of this group? I don't know. That's just, again, brainstorming as Sam Eisner and not as not my official position with ICANN.
But still, Sam, I think your views, even though they are not representing General Counsel's office, are much appreciated by the group, because we've been discussing this for a couple of months now, and I think we are happy to hear fresh and new perspectives and ideas on this. Claudia, please.
Hi, Thomas. Thank you. Samantha, I'd just like to say, as an INGO, as ISO, the International Organization for Standardization, which I can is obviously familiar with because of our popular standard ISO 3166, the country codes, I'd like to just say that we very much appreciate the work that your office has put into this question. And I'd like to just take you up on a comment that you made in terms of maybe some ideas in which way we could take the research. I think a lot of this research has been basically looking at the idea of sort of per se liability for the registration of a name. I wonder if there is scope for us looking at or changing the focus a bit and looking at the possibility of researching areas of legislation where the public interest in protecting an international organization's name is evident. That being, for example, that a special accord or a law that is made between or among an organization and different countries or one particular country, where that country has enacted legislation in view of an international organization's, you know, non-profit, quasi-governmental, international status, putting it in a different category of other nonprofits and other nonprofits that might even operate in one or two countries, but really kind of legislating that recognition that an international organization is so globally active and its work is so influential on an international level, not just with countries but also with other international organizations, that kind of a legislation could be, for example, a way for us to sort of hang our hat on saying, hey, there's some public interest in protecting this international organization's name because there has been at least one country or several countries that have legislated some aspect of the organization as being protected or being special in some way. And I say that because, for example, at ISO, we do have a special fiscal accord with Switzerland. Several other INGOs, a handful, have the same situation. And it's the kind of legislation, I don't pretend to be an expert internationally on how many INGOs or which other ones would have it. I know that in Switzerland there's maybe a handful. But outside of Switzerland, I'm not sure. But I wonder if there's any scope for this kind of research that we could just kind of shift the focus, because for INGOs that might not have a legislated protection other than, of course, trademark law and trademark treaties of their name, there might be a good idea for us to change the focus and talk about the public interest, since the internet is international and it's truly about the public, it's for the public, where there might be an interest in protecting an international organization's name, since it's particularly vulnerable as a nonprofit and not in the same situation as a private trademark owner, to be able to sort of relay the costs of subsequent and intensive domain name abuse.
So thanks for that, Claudia. You know, it sounds like from my first reaction listening to that is, you know, the drafting team itself likely has some opportunity to set out some criteria that might actually reach some of your concerns. You know, if public interest in protecting a certain name, if that can be shown by having a certain number of countries that have legislation that protect a certain name in there, you know, maybe those are some of the criteria that this working group could help come up with in order to formulate the protections. Research being performed out of the Office of the General Counsel to identify where these potential protections may be is the best way to help meet that criteria. I don't know now. You know, it sounds like from the ISO standpoint, you know, you are in a very good position as, you know, representing ISO to identify that the treaties or special legislation that are there. You know, if there are certain organizations that are really active in this process or through communities of INGOs or IGOs that are out there that know of where they have, you know, specifically mentioned protections, you know, it seems like it's a very high bar and a really huge undertaking for us to try to send out attorneys to determine where these protections might be, because, you know, here ISO, we could say, you know, go look to see if ISO has special protections or special legislation in any country, but we would still be missing other organizations, I think, because then we go back to the issue of there's not really a good common definition of what level of INGO particularly would have these types of protections. And so, you know, I'd encourage this to be part of a dialogue among the INGOs and the IGOs and the Strafton team. And then if there's research or assistance needed in verification of some of this stuff, I think that that's where we at ICANN could help provide some objective verification of what's being stated. But I'm not sure that it's it sounds like it's such a hugely scoped thing to try to do research on it anew. From our standpoint, I'm not quite sure how we would achieve that.
Thanks, Sam. I have Stefan next.
Thank you very much. I will speak. I'll come back to more general comments. First of all, from the Red Cross Red Crescent perspective, this is Stefan Hankins, ICRC. First of all, you know, to express appreciation for the work that was produced by the Legal Counsel's Office and the contribution, it is our understanding from last week's discussion, but also this week, that the majority opinion of the working group is that the research is only partly conclusive. As we have made clear in the past calls, that in our view, the reasons why, you know, this is not providing the hook for the hat, I mean, is very largely due to the manner in which the questions were put to counsel and the way they have been interpreted. If only, I mean, very obviously, the expectation that treaties and domestic laws adopted in 1949 and subsequently thereto, which is the date of adoption of the 1949 Geneva Conventions, which protect the Red Cross, Red Crescent, Red Lion, and Sun names, is to expect that, you know, that the treaty or, you know, implementing legislation adopted thereafter, you know, would examine the issue of the liability of domain name registries, registrars, just doesn't make sense. It could hardly be expected, and obviously, you know, it requires an interpretation of the prohibition and the protections of the designations concerned as they were formulated at the time. Obviously, in the absence of a specific reference to domain name registration and a legal duty or liability attached for in the registry registrar chain, and of course, considering, you know, the absence in many jurisdictions of legislation or case law on the liability of registries registrar, whether it is, I don't know, as agents or accessories or anything else, I think a definitive answer was just not a realistic expectation. We note, however, that the report does include this phrase and concludes that there does seem to be potential basis for challenges to be brought, I'm quoting, including potential challenges to registry operators or registries for their roles in the registration chain. So I just, you know, was wondering exactly, you know, what the working group, you know, will take, can and would take from that. And I would like to ask the representative of the legal counsel what she feels, you know, we should take from that assertion you know, what should be, you know, next steps to actually take into consideration what is written there, which does not exclude and suggests that, you know, at least in the jurisdictions examined, only domestic law, international law, was not covered, this, which is a bit curious to us, you know, whether, you know, how this feeds into the issues that the working group is looking at. And I have a second comment that I want to make. We've made this quite a few times already, including at the time when the questions for counsel were being debated. We understand and we read very well that, you know, in the legal counsel's interpretation of the question, you know, it was not to look at or to discuss ICANN's potential for liability, for its own potential for liability, or its own duties stemming from the treaties or the laws concerned. As we've expressed before, you know, this is much to our regret, because I feel that, you know, this would have been central to, you know, the question raised. If we are, as we discussed earlier on this call, we're looking at, you know, preventative mechanisms, you know, these should obviously begin first and foremost within, you know, ICANN's own quote-unquote supervisory role of, you know, these processes. And, you know, we reading also the articles of incorporation, the reference to international treaties, you know, in our view, you know, it's curious that, you know, that this is not part of the legal analysis, especially, I would say, because if you read the question, it does talk about, in its first phrase, is ICANN aware of any jurisdiction in which a statute, treaty, or other applicable law prohibits either or both of the following actions by or under the authority of ICANN? Under the authority of ICANN. So, we feel that, you know, that element is still not, you know, still has not been looked at or sufficiently addressed. It's not, I mean, you know, that there is necessarily a legal liability, but that, you know, at least the duty, a duty of care maybe, to ensure to take all possible measures within the authority of the organization to ensure that, you know, one, that, you know, they be aware of these international, that registrars are aware of these protections, and then perhaps potentially more than that, you know, some form of instruction to implement. So I'll leave it at that. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Stefan. Sam, would you like to respond to that?
Sure. Thank you, Stefan. As to your first point, you know, one of the things that we definitely did find in the throughout the research is, you know, particularly as it relates to the ISC and the Red Cross, so many of those protections are so longstanding, you know, 1910, 1930, 1945, that of course we wouldn't expect to see domain name registrations set out in there. And so that's one of the reasons that we look to see or perform some evaluation as to whether or not there would be other places where we would think that the protections that are afforded would actually attach to domain name registration, and then that's the research that resulted. So, of course, you know, the way that the question was asked, the answer in most cases had to be no, because the statutes or the treaties themselves do not say ICANN registry or registrar or domain name registration. But we tried not to stop the answer there. You know, in terms of where ICANN stands in this, you know, we do take our role and the work that we do very seriously, and, you know, as you've seen through the protections that have already been put in place through the new GTLD program, you know, we consider that our role within this is very important, and know that we have a really important place to help set the standards to which we expect our contracted parties and others to operate. In terms of, because we did not find a specific or in most cases, we did not find a specific piece of legislation or statute that didn't specifically say, I can't do this. We do have, we would have provided those for you if they were in existence. We think that the support that we can give to this working group is part of our commitment to providing guidance on how the statutes that do exist can be met, which is why we undertook a very large piece of work here to try to get the information out, and so we do hold our role here as very important. So, we do look to see if we can support you in any other way. So please let us know as your work continues here in the drafting team.
Thanks, Sam. The IOC is next, so we will either hear from Jim, Kieran, or David. We can't hear you. Maybe your microphone is on mute.
They got disconnected. They're calling back in.
Okay. Just reading it in the chat. Do we have any further questions?
And I just so you know, Thomas, I do have a meeting that starts at 11 o'clock, so I will have to leave at that point. If it's of value for me to come back to a later meeting, please let Brian know, and I'm happy to come back.
That's much appreciated. Sam, I guess we've already taken more time of you than anticipated, but I'm happy for us to have this vivid discussion, and I'm very thankful for you to be there for almost an hour already and answer the questions. I guess this
Thomas,
is
I'm back on.
Jim, please go ahead.
I'm sorry, I got cut off. I just wanted to thank Sam, Samantha, for her report, and mention that actually Stefan's comment took in a lot of what I wanted to say on the point about the statutes. I would make the additional point that more recent statutes for the IOC, such as Brazil and Greece, both specifically do mention domain names and websites, so that, as the Internet's come on into its own, I think new legislation is considering specific extension to Internet domain names. On the other points, I think that both Alan and Thomas, you and Samantha mentioned the fact that, what do we do with people who have legitimate rights, grandfathered rights, rights in news articles and things of that type. And I think that we're going to discuss later an exception procedure for second-level domains that could deal with that issue so that there would be protections granted subject to somebody with a legitimate right being able to establish their right on the second level in some manner that would be both fast and efficient and impartial.
Thanks, Jim. I guess we will get to the discussion of the exemption mechanism and your i.e. David's proposal in a couple of minutes. Are there any more urgent questions for Sam? Because otherwise I'd like to let Samantha go. Sam, thanks again for being available and answering to our questions and also for your willingness to come back to this group and continue the conversation. So that's much appreciated. And again, on behalf of the whole group, I'd like to thank you, and please convey our thanks to General Counsel as well.
Will do. Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Sam.
Right.
Now, with this, we can move to the third agenda item, which is a protections proposal, as we called it. You will see the document in the Adobe in a moment, and that is actually another attempt to provide an overview of where our discussion is, and it basically slices the issues that we're discussing. into smaller portions, which hopefully will help the group get a good overview of where we are, what we need to achieve, where potential consensus is, and where we need to work more on consensus positions. Barry, I'm not sure whether you have difficulties bringing the document up or whether it's just on my machine, because at the moment I just see the name of the document, but I can't see the document itself in the Adobe.
Thomas, it is up. It may be your machine.
Okay, that's good. Since I can't see the document, Barry, thanks so much for putting this together and making it look as it does. Would you be kind enough to maybe give the group an overview of what's in there?
Yes, sure, Thomas. This is Barry. So carrying on what Thomas had just mentioned, the document you see before you is kind of an extension of what we were working through the protection spreadsheet over the last couple of meetings. And the thought here was to try to transform that tool into a set of possible working recommendations that the working group can establish which ones are viable, which ones might not be viable. And so the first aspect here is to try to lay out onto in a Word format, you know, what are some possible outcomes of the working group. Essentially, there are four listed here. By no means are they the only four, and certainly any one of these outcomes described here, with the exception of number one, there could be some kind of reshaping of some of these outcomes. But essentially, you know, we're trying to lay down as to where consensus could possibly be achieved, some of which are aligned to the polarized positions that we have right now within the working group. And then, of course, the final outcome is to try to define some middle ground. And, of course, this is divided between top-level and second-level protection. So I'd just like to first point out that this is a first draft. Certainly the language listed within here is not written by a lawyer, so I'm sure there's lots of room for improvement, and perhaps some of the statements in here are vague and can use I can use some assistance to make them more direct as well. So I won't read through the entire document. I understand that the working group only received this either late last night or early this morning, so there hasn't been time to digest what's written here. But I'll just quickly provide a high-level overview of each one of the outcomes, and then hopefully we as a working group can work towards refining this document, and at the very least, hopefully it becomes a useful tool for us to achieve some sort of consensus position out of this. So basically starting with outcome one, this is more or less the easy one, for lack of a better word. If this working group cannot find consensus on some form of recommendations for protection of identifiers, this is most likely the outcome that we're faced with today. As everybody is aware, the ICANN board has placed a few resolutions in previous meetings affording temporary protections for the first round of IOC, RCRC names, as well as IGO names that are listed within 2.2.1.2.3 of the applicant guidebook. Below the first element of the outcome is kind of some general rationale for what the outcome may produce. Again, I invite the working group members to take a close read at this and also look forward to any feedback that the working group may have as to some of the statements listed here. But in short, absent of any consensus position coming out of this, this is most likely what the community is faced with and what the board has already implemented to date or in the process of implementing. The second page is basically a slight derivatives of the first outcome. Essentially, this is where we start getting into possible consensus positions that could be created from the working group. Outcome 2A is that basically the working group has defined the consensus position that no protection should be afforded, and in the face of that deliberation, that perhaps the temporary protection granted by the ICANN board should be retracted as well. A secondary outcome is that the working group comes together and that there are protections granted to IGO, INGO organizations, in that they are made permanent and not only temporary. And, of course, this outcome 2B is would also require some additional effort to accommodate the positions of exception processes, et cetera. I think the one thing to note here is that what has been implemented to date is very limiting in terms of any kind of exception processes should these identifiers be listed on the reserve names list. Most importantly, we have certain protections or objection processes at the top level, but then we also, where I think more of the attention needs to be focused, is what would happen at the second level. And if names were placed on the reserve names list to date without any creation of other exception processes, the only thing available to the community is the RCEP process. So, for example, if a particular string was placed on the reserve names list and an organization that is seeking the protections wished to register that name, at the current time frame, we only have the RCEP process, which stands for the Registry Services Evaluation Process, in which that said protected organization would need to work with a specific registry operator to have a particular name removed from the reserve names list and for to make it available for registration. And certainly that process is not an overnight overnight process. David, I see your hand is up. And then Alan. And David, you may be on mute.
Sorry, I was. I think there's an additional outcome that is a possibility. The registry stakeholder group has not voted yet on its position, but one of the positions that is being offered for vote by the registry stakeholder group, which is essentially continuing the position that they've taken before. That is that there are no special protections, but support for the drafting team resolution outcome protecting the IOC and the Red Cross, but no other organizations. In other words, support for the board position on the top level and the drafting team position on second level.
All right, great. Thank you, David. Since you mentioned it, I think as you said, your stakeholder group is working on formulating something like that. When as soon as possible, if you could share that on the mailing list, and I can incorporate that into the document. And certainly, as I mentioned, what I have listed here is not a definitive list. It's very clear there are going to be probably several variations of what I'd call more of a straw man than a proposal at this point that the working group can consider. So we would appreciate some kind of written form so that I can incorporate that into the document.
Okay.
Alan.
Thank you very much. The reference to the RCEP process I find interesting. I can imagine an outcome of this group saying that names be protected subject to registries filing RCEPs for exemptions. And that could be fair. However, if this group comes out and does not make that explicit statement, I would question whether it's intuitively obvious that an RCEP would be granted in the absence of an explicit intent of this group to use that as the escape hatch. If I was in a position to judge whether an RCEP should be granted for a particular case, and the organization in question had agreed through this working group that they not that that name go onto a protected list, it's not intuitively obvious to me that an RCEP would be a valid way of getting an exemption for that. So I just raised the issue that we can't assume that's going to happen. If that's the way we want to create the exception, then I think we're going to have to explicitly say that. And I for one, do not favor that. That's a cumbersome, expensive process to go through for exceptions, which in some cases I suspect they're going to be expected. You know, if there's a dot charity, I'm expecting that some organizations will want to be present there, and it would be a wrong thing to do to grant a general protection then expect the RCEP process to be used to get around that. I find that a cumbersome and very expensive process to a responsibility to put on the community. Thank you.
Thank you, Alan. And yes, you are correct. It's definitely not an easy process, and I'll defer to Chuck. I believe he has much more experience with it than I do. And certainly even filing an RCEP is, you know, no guarantee of acceptance of that RCEP. Certainly the process in of itself is once the RCEP is filed, there's a review by the by ICANN, as well as it's opened up for public comment to receive input from the community, and a series of decision processes that are exercised through that process. So without a doubt, it's definitely not a simple and overnight procedure. Chuck, please.
Thanks. It's important that we understand the conditions around the RCEP. First of all, I'm going to comment on a lot of things, but there is no formal public comment period with RCEPs. They are put out for public comment and so forth. But that's not officially a part of the process. More importantly, there are two reasons. Assuming that a registry service is proposed that doesn't contradict other essential elements of the registry agreement, there are only two criteria that would disallow an RCEP. One of them has to do with security and stability, and the other one has to do with competition concerns. The RCEP process only becomes real expensive if you have to go to the Registry Services Evaluation Panel to evaluate whether or not it's a security and stability issue. The other alternative, if ICANN staff determines that they think there may be competition issues, it would be referred to whoever the applicable competition authorities are in whatever jurisdictions at stake. So it's important that we understand that when we're talking about an RCEP. If an RCEP that's proposed doesn't affect security, if there's no indication that it affects security and stability or that it's a competition issue, then it's really not that complicated. Hope that helps.
Great. Thank you, Chuck. I think that is very helpful. And I should point out that at least everything that we've researched so far, this is the only process that may be available. I'd certainly invite the working group, if they have other ideas of other existing processes that could possibly be used to provide an exception process in this regard, please help us inform that. Otherwise, absent of anything else or to make something more streamlined in this regard, it would probably be a recommendation that this working group would have to deliberate on and create. Chuck, please.
Yeah, just one more thought on that, and thanks, Brian. The NRSUP would only be needed if there's an exception to something in the registry agreement. For example, if there were reserve names or specially reserved names or whatever term we want to use, and a registrar wanted to make an exception to those, then they would need to submit an RCEP. But if there are no protections, an RCEP anyway for particular names, I don't believe there's anything in the registry agreements or registrar agreements for that matter that would prevent them from implementing their own protections. Thanks.
Great. Thank you, Chuck. And yeah, I guess to provide some clarity, is the way I understood it is Specification 6 of the registry agreement contains those names that are on the reserve list. And that's why I was tying in the RCEP process, because it would require that name be removed from the registry agreement of that specific TLD to allow it to be registered, while it would be blocked or remain on the reserve names list across all the other registry agreements. And I see a green checking mark to Chuck, so thank you. Aubrey.
Yeah, thanks. So I just want to make sure if I was understanding Chuck correctly. If, for example, one of the recommendations that came out of this group was, we're not putting, and this is just an example, we're not putting more names on the reserve list, but we are creating a set of names that we recommend, you know, kind of like the way we had originally started a thought that RPMs would work, is that we would create them and invite every registry to implement something of their choice and encourage them to do so. So that if registries were to create additional reserved name lists specific to that registry, those would not require an RCEP. Those would require whatever registry process the registry itself put in for those. Because, I mean, as we look at, you know, the new applicants, there are all sorts of reserved name lists that they're creating because of, you know, because of GAC comments, because of groups like this, because of other comments, long lists of names that those registries voluntarily say they will not register. And this going together with what Sam said before of every registry, every registrar has an obligation essentially to create that sort of extra list on itself. But for the set of all those lists, for something to come off it, how something would come off that would be up to the registry and or registrar. And I think that's what I understood. Thanks.
And this is Chuck. I think that's true, Aubrey. Now, as you know, I'm not an attorney and fully qualified to evaluate all the nuances of the registry agreements, but I believe that's true. Now, one of the things that's a little complicated right now is we've got a registry agreement for new GTLDs, and certainly I think we know that for new GTLDs, registries have an opportunity to provide more protections than the minimum. I think that's also true with existing TLDs, but it's probably not quite as clear in the existing range. As long as it doesn't change our agreement, I think that's absolutely true even with regard to existing registries. But somebody correct me if you think I'm off base there.
Thank you, Chuck. My individual perspective, I would agree with that statement as well. And I believe, a few applicants have already come out and stated that they would offer up an additional reservation of names for their proposed TLDs. Aubrey.
Yeah. So to add to the multiple choice of possible outcomes, and this perhaps is one for those of us that are more into voluntary blocking than I can enforce blocking, if this group were to recommend either a list or a formula or a combination of a list and a formula dealing with the prefix, postfix, and infix cases, and suggest that, you know, registries add this to those public interest comments that they're making, the PICs, that could indeed be another kind of recommendation that this group could make that stopped short of adding things to the reserve list, the enforced observe list, but going to something that was more jurisdictionally specific, was more, you know, takes into account, for example, how .charity, if such were to exist, and I don't even know if it does, were to sort of say, we've put all these names there, but we have a process by which, you know, you can get the name open if you want to use our services, blah, blah, blah. So basically, one of the options we would have would be to create lists that were voluntary and even a recommendation that, you know, look at adding these things to your PIC. Thanks.
Thank you, Aubrey. Any other comments for Aubrey, one more comment?
No, I'm just trying to put it down and spazzing.
Oh, all right, sorry. Any other quick comments before I move on to the third outcome, or I should say the fourth, which is labeled number three? And I won't go through the details of this, and again, I invite the working group to read through the through each one of these proposed recommendations, or I should say straw man recommendations, and to help improve some of the language here and some of the rationale. This outcome is certainly a derivative from the spreadsheet that we were working on the past couple of weeks, and it also tried to incorporate much of the dialogue that occurred over the last couple of weeks as well. And it's basically split into three tables. The first table being the recommendations or proposed recommendations around top-level identifier protections. The second table is focusing on second-level registrations. And then the third, which is kind of the unknown at this point, is, you know, what would possible qualification criteria be? And as you can see in the comment on the side, many of these recommendations in the first two tables will key off of any possible recommendation that the working group may come up with in regards to qualification criteria in of itself, which is certainly a separate document that we've sent out that has a history of proposals of what that QC may look like. But in a nutshell, so with the top-level identifier protection, basically this mostly keyed off, I believe Alan made some great statements either last meeting or the meeting prior to that, that permanent protections at the top level, it seems that we're at a point where that may not necessarily be a direct threat, and thus that perhaps such top-level permanent protections may not be necessary. And certainly carrying on some of the key elements to this is that go ahead, Alice.
Yeah, I just want to emphasize that I have raised this a number of times, but I've been clear to say it's that I suspect existing protections are sufficient. If they are existing objection processes are sufficient. However, if they are not, if we can identify a hole in the a break in the wall, which says certain things the objection processes would not be sufficient, then we need to invent a new objection process for future rounds to make sure that the kind of organizations we're talking about are thoroughly protected and still, of course, allow, you know, other legitimate rights to be exercised. So I've never said that the existing objection mechanisms are sufficient. I've said the existing ones or, if necessary, additional ones. And I think it's important to do that because there may well be a hole in the overall armor And I don't think anyone's looked at it from a perspective of protecting the IGO, INGO organizations we're talking about with the existing protection mechanisms, that objection mechanisms, that wasn't what they were invented for. So I'm just adding that caveat. Thank you.
Great. Thank you for the clarification, Alan, and I apologize if I misspoke. And certainly that is the essence of the third recommendation here for the top-level recommendations, is that basically 1 year post first delegation, there is an affirmation of commitments review that is twofold. The first is that there's a review on the success of the new GPLD program as it relates to consumer trust, consumer choice, and competition. There's also a secondary review involved that is to review the application process from start to delegation. And so this is the nature of the third recommendation, is at this point, given, you know, we've seen all of the strings applied for, at this point it seems clear that there were no applications that infringe on any of the IGO, INGO names that are in question. And the essence of this recommendation is, first, let's conduct a review post delegation and after the application process closes to ensure that there aren't any gaps that may limit IGO, INGO participation in that process, as well as the second recommendation. And Alan, I think you had mentioned this before, that the GAC and ALAC are afforded a certain standing that allows them to file objections through this process. So in essence, you know, it would be a review of these at the top level. Alan, please.
Yeah, I agree that the AOC review that will follow is a good escape hatch to catch something that is done wrong. However, I want to emphasize that in this group, if there are people representing the IGOs, INGOs, that feel that the existing protections are not sufficient, if we do not have an explicit top-level prohibition, but if they feel uncomfortable that the existing existing objection mechanisms are sufficient, then I think the onus is on this group to try to identify what additional objection mechanisms should be put in place in the future. So yes, the AOC review is another mechanism later on, but I think our overall remit is to make sure that we provide reasonable protection at the first and second levels to the kinds of names we're looking at, and therefore if we choose not to put them on a reserve list, we have to ensure that the objection processes do cover the whole gamut of worries that they may have. So, and that's why I've emphasized again and again that we must look at it, and if that's the route we go, it is our responsibility to say what's missing, if there is anything. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Alan. Any other comments before I move down to the second level table? All right. This one is, I think, a series of about seven or eight proposed recommendations for the working group to deliberate on. I won't really go through these in detail, but in essence, the idea here is to try to leverage existing platforms and processes for the protection of names. And in very short terms is to try to leverage the Trademark Clearinghouse, its Sunrise, and its trademark claims processes where possible, and as well as to, I think, one of the main issues for IGO and INGO organizations is that the pursuit of protection does prevent the use of funds in promoting the public interest for their organization strategy, et cetera. So that's what this basically tries to capture, is leveraging the existing Trademark Clearinghouse, Sunrise, and claims processes where possible, and to provide those protections in a way that are fruitful while not necessarily relying on the reserve names list as the protection element. And I think the important thing here is that, again, it kind of circles back just with the top-level domain, is that if names were to wind up on a reserve names list, it's going to be a difficult process for the organization seeking protection to use those names if they wished, as the example was mentioned earlier, a .charity or something along those lines. So the essence of this third table, again, is to try to balance the needs of both while not necessarily trying to prevent registration of certain names. Again, I won't go through details on this. I invite the working group to read through these. Please provide me red lines of feedback that you have on some of the language here, and I would be happy to incorporate this into a go-forward model that we can start to deliberate on. And then lastly, as I mentioned, there's a third table that gets into qualification criteria, which at this point I've just left as blank. So with that, there are no other questions. Thomas, I'll turn it back to you and happy to answer any other questions.
Thanks so much, Barry. Any questions regarding the document or comments? Do you think this is useful? At least I do think it is, because it puts everything into one document that we can comment on. So basically, if you look at that, we have the options that we're going to enrich by the options that have been mentioned during this call, and that might be based on the mailing list. Also, it will be important to note that we have the option of saying yes and no to all four categories of organizations separately. That's something that we agreed on early in the process, and if we then enrich the document further by further defining an exemption mechanism, as well as defining criteria, which we had parked for the moment, then I think we have everything in one place. Can I get some indication of whether you think this is useful, or would you rather proceed working on a document in a different format? So seeing no hands and hearing no comments, I take this as agreement that you think this is useful. And if you think that my understanding of your silence is incorrect, you should speak up now. Okay, so let's then try to further refine the document and the options therein to get a more holistic view on that. I see the IOC's hand up, please.
Thomas, this is Jim Bykov. I was just going to say that I haven't had a chance to look at the document yet. I think it came in early this morning, but we'll look at it and I guess get back on the listserv.
Thank you, Jim. That's much appreciated. Okay, unless there are further comments or proposals from the group, I guess we should look at the exemption process now. And at this stage, I'd like to thank David, Jim, and Kieran again for putting together and further detailing the proposal, the basic parameters for an exemption process. Unfortunately, neither Robin nor Mason do seem to be on the call, because there has been some communication on the mailing list. Both Robin and Mason have voiced concerns with the exception process, and I've responded to them asking exactly what that meant, whether, any type of preventative measures is something that they wouldn't be able to support. The second question was if there was no such fundamental objection to preventive mechanisms, to what extent we would need to tweak the exemption mechanism so that it would constitute a basis for discussion for you, or, you know, that is, or provide the group with the opportunity to further discuss amendments so that, that we could get, possibly get a consensus. As I mentioned on the mailing list, it was my understanding that the group felt an exemption process to be necessary to be in place. And certainly an exemption process is an extra process that would create burden for players engaged in that process. And the comments that we saw, at least I understood, to represent the view that everything that would create a burden on the on somebody trying to register a domain name would not be acceptable. But maybe we can hear Robin and Mason's view on that later on. Alan has mentioned that he also commented on the list, and I must have overlooked that because I've been traveling all day and now doing this call after having one meeting after the other today. So I apologize for that and not acknowledging Alan's feedback on the list. I'm sure, Alan, that you will voice your concerns or provide your comments during this call. But first, I'd like to move to Avery, please.
Hi, this is Avery. Okay, first, I did not voice any opinion on the list. I was fine to ride in and Robin and Mason's wake on it. I guess I have two issues. One is a prior issue in that the existence of this procedure seems to rest on the notion that names are blocked by some list or blocked by some activity, not just the period of 30 days and of notifications, but actually that there's a block. And the presumption of a block is certainly something that I haven't accepted, and I think we should be eliminating the blocks that currently do exist as opposed to adding further. So any procedure that is based upon there being blocked names is, of course, a problem. There's an existential problem with it. Now, accepting a sort of, you know, theoretical position that, well, we might as well talk at one, about one just in case we do reach consensus on blocking mechanisms, then I also have a problem with any process, and this one seems to include that, that includes the possibility, and please, I'm not accusing anyone of any intentional acts, but any process that looks like it allows for a either implicit or explicit notion of licensing, tit for tat, quid pro quo, whatever you want to call it, where of course we will give you, our great donor, an exemption. And as I say, this process seems to have many different ways in which one could weave in sort of a round-the-corner, semi-gaming notion of, you know, I apply for the exception, you know, process, process, wink, wink, process, process, okay, you've got the exemption. So, A, I don't see why we need an exemption if we have no blocking, but B, if we do have blocking and exemptions, I have problems with anything that includes considerations by the people who make claims on the name. I think it would have to be a process that was yet another independent ICC type, neutral, working on a set of principles type of group. Thank you.
Thanks, Avery. And before I move to Alan, I'd actually like to ask you a follow-up question. You have mentioned the word blocking, and blocking has been mentioned all over a couple of times during our discussions over the last couple of months. At least, as far as I'm concerned, blocking to me would be an absolute prevention of a resignation, of a registration, excuse me. Would you already, by definition, regard an exemption process as blocking just because it requires further steps, whatever these steps might look like, prior to a registration taking place?
Okay. It's my assumption that you don't need to be accepted from something if you haven't been excluded from it first. So it's just in the notion of to get an exemption means without the exception you are blocked, whether it is because you are on a reserve list or some other sort of entity has been created that says you may not pass here unless you have an exception. At the moment, a reserve list has the exception of RCEP. Now, that's perhaps too arduous, and also that doesn't offer some of the opportunities that this procedure offers, so therefore I could see why people would prefer this procedure to an RCEP procedure. But in essence, both of them are exemptions to not being allowed to proceed. So whether we call it blocking, which I guess is getting a negative connotation, or being on a reserve list or something is, yes, indeed problematic.
I'll be sorry for following up again, but I guess we need to get a common understanding of the terminology. And I think that we should try to get away from these terms that have certain connotations that might lead to misunderstandings in the group. As far as I'm concerned, at least from what I've heard as chair, there was the general notion that an exemption process or something, you know, that could be circumscribed as an exemption process would be needed to ensure that legitimate use is given enough space. I think it's not correct to derive from that notion that per se the sister to an exemption mechanism would be a reserve names list, i.e. a blocking mechanism, as you would call it. Maybe we as a group need to step back a little bit, take a bird's perspective, and maybe make a distinction between domain names that can be registered by anybody in the world without any difficulty, and those names that would only have a certain number of eligible registrants. And these eligible registrants can either be the organizations, in this case, that have asked for protection, or any other third party that can legitimately use the name. So that the reservation, as you call it, if we don't call it reservation, but it would just mean that we have a decision to make how to deal with these names where that not everybody in the world is eligible to register. And then, depending on how we shape the process, it could be a level playing field for the organizations in question or a legitimate third party. And so I guess the question that I'm asking you is whether you would accept the fact that certain names would need or would require a certain type of eligible party, regardless of who that ultimately might be and who gets access to the name, that can be or could be discussed in order to avoid what you call a licensing scheme? Or would such differentiation between names that everybody is eligible to register and those where only certain eligible parties can register go too far in your view?
Okay, thanks. Okay, I see two categories. There are names that anybody can register for, and there are names that nobody can register for. I think to create a, to spin another category out of the names no one can register for, to create a set of names that only some can get, can register for, nonetheless means that most of the world is blocked on them. And it's just basically a way of spinning the story so that it doesn't look like we're blocking people. I still see that as a blocking notion, and because a priori, you have to prove you deserve the name as opposed to anyone can register for it. And so everyone is blocked until they get licensed. That, to me, is blocking. So, no, I don't see the category as legitimate.
Thanks for that clarification, Avi. Alan.
Thank you. On the last part of the discussion first, I agree we need to have common words that we all understand what it means, but I do not think we want to get into a game of semantics of what does the generic meaning of something. You know, as in contracts, if you have a capitalized term, it means what you define it to mean, and it doesn't matter if it's used in a different sense in the general language, and I think that's where we are right now. Up until now, unless I missed something very substantive, we've been talking about blocking as opposed to a claims notice where you must tick off a box on the web form and then you go forward without a problem. Or blocking as opposed to some other mechanism we're talking about. So blocking is blocking. Now, if we want to come up with a different term which says, which means where we say blocking means no one can ever get it, period, no exceptions, and a different word that we invent to say there will be an exception process which can be followed, fine, let's do that. You know, but let's not talk about, spend our time talking about semantics. If indeed we have a concept of blocking, that is, you cannot get it through the normal registration process that one goes through today, but one has to go through some other hurdles other than just ticking off a box on a claims notice, then we have to look at what that process is. I disagree with Avery, by the way, that there may well be cases where there is remuneration involved. You know, if you go to the Red Cross website, they sell a whole bunch of products. There's radios and lanterns and first aid kits and things, all of which bear the name Red Cross. And I can imagine scenarios where the vendors of those products could use the name Red Cross in a part of a domain name, just as they use it in their product name, you know, but with money going back to the Red Cross. It's a fundraising activity, sure. But we're not talking about those. Those are private agreements, and that's a different issue. What we're talking about here are someone comes up and says, I want to use this name. Oops. You know, ISO, which is well known for all sorts of things, but is also the acronym for many other organizations. And especially in tailored TLDs, it may have a meeting which has nothing to do with standards. That is a much more common use of those three letters in the context of that TLD. And if we're going to have a blocking mechanism which says, yes, there's a way to get around it, the proposed one we're looking at is just, in my mind, not acceptable. To say it will take weeks to go through, even if the outcome is positive, to say if the organization says, no, you can't have it, you have to then go through an arbitration mechanism. Well, the cheapest arbitration mechanism we know of now is the URS, which is a $300 expense. That's 30 years of domain registration at the typical $10 a domain cost that we're seeing today. And, you know, to say it's going to take weeks or months, you may have to hire a lawyer, and there's going to be fees associated with which are multiples, high multiples of the cost of the registration, is just not a reasonable process in my mind, certainly not from my community's point of view. Thank you.
Thanks, Alan. Chuck.
Thanks, Thomas. I'm going to talk about something different than what Avery and Alan were talking about. So if Mary wants to follow up in what either one of them said, I am fine with that.
Mary?
Okay. I was just trying to digest what Alan said. So I wanted to go back to Avery's comments. And then as I said on the mailing list today, I think, and I've said this before, I think the sort of procedures that we design at this stage, whether they're exception procedures or something else, is the process is very closely related to what exactly the protections are that we come up with. So for what that's worth, my view is similar to what's been expressed by Avery, David, and others, that essentially if you're going to have an exception procedure that looks like what we have up here on the screen, it needs to be fairly limited and very well specified. And what makes the most sense is that it is limited to a list of reserved names, however we define that. Because that's clear, that's a list, and we know what that is. The other thing I wanted to bring up, it's just a thought that occurred to me as I was looking through this, was leaving that aside and then going back to some of the discussions we had over trademark protections in the IRT and STI process. If instead of an exception procedure where the burden of proof essentially is shifted, right, to the potential registrant or applicant, that you had the kind of claims notice process that the community has agreed to for trademark owners, so that if the application proceeds with the potential applicant saying, yes, I understand that, you know, this is close to or it matches a name on the protected list, but I warrant that this is non-infringing, et cetera, then a notice can also be sent to the protected organizations, at which point, if they believe there is a real case for dispute, then the dispute resolution procedures that we talk about right now in this document could kick in. So I don't know if that's something that folks want to talk about, a good idea, bad idea, but I just wanted to suggest it.
Thanks. Chuck, you're next.
Thank you, Thomas. And by the way, just to throw in a prefatory comment, Mary, I agree with you that it should be limited, so I'm with you all the way on that. Now, I'd like to talk about, if it's okay, the general principles that are listed on the procedures here, or just before the procedures, especially the first two. I'm fine with the third and fourth general principles. But I think the first two need some qualifications. The first one says provide immediate notification to the applicant and the protected organization. That may or may not be necessary depending on implementation model. The applicant, knowing that a name is reserved, could actually take care of the communication in advance, and so no more communication is needed. Now, that gets probably a little bit messy and more time-consuming to follow on with Alan's concerns. But let's take the example. Let's say that an applicant for a special reserve name had a trademark rights to that name, even though they're not part of the protected organization. Then it could simply be a matter of checking the trademark clearinghouse, seeing if they do have a trademark and making sure that they know that they can't use the name in a way that causes confusion or something like that. That could be a checkbox or something. So there wouldn't necessarily have to be immediate communication between the parties. Again, there may be, depending, a need for immediate communication. Certainly, if it is, I believe it should be immediate, but there are ways that this could be implemented that wouldn't require that. On the second bullet, provide a channel of communication between the applicant and the protected organization. Again, that may or may not be necessary to have that. If it's a really straightforward procedure, like, for example, they just need to show that they have trademark rights for the name, which is one way this thing could go, then there needs to be no communication with the applicant, except in certain jurisdictions, and that might be have to be handled by the registrar involved. Because if you go back to the general counsel's response to us, they noted in some cases for where there were protections for some of the organizations studied, whether it be IOC, Red Cross, or IGOs, there several of them referred to kind of their own exception process. There was an approval required sometimes by the protected organization. So that's a caveat to what I'm saying here. That's all I've got. Thanks.
Thanks, Chuck. You've been very helpful, and I'd like us to continue the conversation on these points and also on Mary's proposal on the mailing list. Do you have any further comments on the document or on the exception procedure? I guess that the fundamental positions that are represented in the... I see the IOC's hands up, please.
Thomas, this is David Heasley speaking. We believe that the exception procedure flows from the qualification criteria that we've been discussing and gives us perspective on that. Essentially, Mary Wong has already provided the rationale behind the qualification criteria, and we think that the model Alpha Bravo, which we combined together, provide sufficient justification for the kind of protection we're talking about, because it comprehends the idea that the organization has shown that its primary mission is of such importance to the public interest that it receives multilateral or multinational protection, and some form of special protection for its name can be justified. And beyond that, your four amalgamations show how each of the organizations, not just the IOC, but also the Red Cross and potentially others, satisfy those criteria. The bottom line from that, I think, is that once they've shown that some form of special protection for the name is justified, that should take the form of a presumptive preventive protection, because ordinary RPMs simply wouldn't work. They'd be outstripped or too expensive, for example. And if you look at it from that perspective, then we understand that the exemption procedure presupposes a presumptive preventive protection of the sort we've been talking about. So when we look at the exemption procedure, we can see that the goal there is to, when somebody comes along who claims a legitimate interest, they should be able to be heard and have that considered as soon as possible. And if we get to the general principles, I think Chuck's comments are quite accurate. It is possible for an applicant to contact the organization in advance and thereby open a channel of communication early on. And we can certainly tweak those to provide for that. If the applicant doesn't do that, then both the applicant and the organization should be notified quickly if there's a conditional refusal based on the protected name. And there should be some expeditious way of resolving this claim of legitimate right to use it. The fastest way we could think of is to come up with this declaration of legitimate use to which the protected organization could or might not object. And if there's no objection, then it simply goes ahead. That's not the same as a licensing regime because, as you pointed out correctly, Thomas, the applicant in that case would be a legitimate eligible party and would be in the group entitled to use the name, and the organization would have admitted that by not objecting. The next step after that, if there is an objection from the organization, is what kind of an examination procedure can we come up with that would be quick and inexpensive, exactly the way Alan has indicated. So I think that's sort of the next step is what people could suggest with respect to Part 3, the examination procedure. Those are my comments.
Thanks very much. I guess that's very helpful. It sort of sets the scene nicely for my comment, and that is that whoever thinks that, you know, he or she should not fundamentally oppose against an exemption process should help refine it so that, or at least come up with proposals to give the group a chance of refining it. Let me note again that we haven't made much progress with respect to the protection mechanisms and the criteria or the hurdles to be able to get access to them during the last couple of calls. I've encouraged the group multiple times to specify the conditions that they want to attach to the protection mechanisms that we're discussing. I think we can't do any better than work with what we have. So if you want to make yourself heard, and if there are things that you think can be added to the proposals that would help you to say yes to them, then please do share that with us. I'm cognizant of the fact that we have parked the question of qualification criteria because the group, or these big parts of the group, felt that they should see more of a holistic picture of what a set of recommendations might look like, and also look at the protections for top versus second level, for names versus acronyms, and then maybe attach a different qualification criteria to these individual smaller pieces. But I think that the time has come for you to actually come up with those suggestions. And I think we need to flesh out more what this exception process could look like. I think we also need to put some flesh to the bones in terms of what qualification criteria, if any, need to be attached to what protection mechanisms for the top versus second level and for names or acronyms. It's 6 minutes to the hour, and I just wanted to make this final comment as usual to encourage your active participation. I know that some of you have and continue to constantly contribute to this process, which is very much appreciated, but I think that we really need to put something into the document so that we have something to say yes or no to. Now, with that, I'd like to move to the next agenda item, and that is the discussion of the format for the face-to-face meeting. And first of all, I guess, Brian, we have some news to report in terms of time and date, right?
Yes, it has been confirmed for Monday the 8th, and the session will be, we'll be able to move it in the afternoon so it no longer conflicts with the new GTLD update session. So it'll be from 1600 to 1730 local time on Monday the 8th. And as I just checked, it is up on the new revised schedule that's available on the, you know, on the ICANN website, so people can take a look at the schedule there, and it's reflected there. The other thing, very quickly, just to let you know, I did also confirm with Sam, to the extent that her schedule is available, she would be happy to sit in, you know, for at least part of the session as well in Beijing to facilitate any further discussions or questions that might arise. So, again, she, you know, her schedule isn't set yet, but to the extent that she's available, she would be happy to offer her availability to if the working group would like her to be present for that time.
Thanks, that's much appreciated. So we now have the date and the time, which is great. In terms of format, have you been able to give any thought to the question of who shall be present? Is it just us discussing further? Shall we invite other external parties to the meeting? Any thoughts or suggestions on that? Chuck, please.
Thanks, Thomas. You know, it's pretty standard practice in ICANN public meetings to make them open to anybody who wants to attend. Now, it's okay to give participants in the working group some priority, but it's also a good time to get input from those who haven't participated. So I think that's a good precedent to continue.
Thanks, Chuck, and I should clarify that I was not suggesting that it should be a closed meeting. the question should rather be, are we waiting for people to come in, or shall we specifically invite certain parts of the community to come to the meeting to better understand the process? But please do give that some further thought. I had proposed that maybe we could reach out to the GAC and in terms of early engagement, encourage GAC representatives to come and see what we're discussing so that they hopefully get a better understanding of why it takes us so long to address and respond to a question that in the eyes of some might seem to be very simple to answer. But please do provide some feedback on that on the list. The next call is going to be in a week's time, and I hope that we're going to be able to make substantial progress with the documents that we have in front of us. The week afterwards, in 2 weeks, on the 3rd of April, I will have difficulty to chair the meeting because I will be on a plane at that time. So either the group wishes to do some homework in that week and then continue our conversation on site in Beijing on Monday, or we would need to have a volunteer to replace me as chair. Is there anybody who would like to volunteer to chair so that we can continue our discussion? Alan, please.
Yeah, we're talking about the Wednesday just preceding the Beijing meeting, correct?
That is correct.
Yeah, I think half of the people, or almost all these people, are either going to be on planes or at their last day in work and frantically trying to get things completed before disappearing halfway around the world. I think it's totally unreasonable to try to hold a meeting that week. I, for one, will be on an airplane. I'll be on an airplane also, for the record. But
and I see some comments in the chat that others are flying as well. So let's then consider the meeting on the 3rd canceled, but we have to find ways to keep up the energy and get some work done in the week between the 3rd and our meeting on site. And with this, I'd like to ask you whether you have any urgent remarks to make. Otherwise, I would like to close this meeting. Thank you. Avery is asking, keep up what energy? I guess you should see my comment more as an encouragement rather than an observation. So thanks, everybody, for your participation today. Have an excellent day and remaining week, and I'm looking forward to talking to you next week, Wednesday, and also reading you on the mailing list. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thanks for another great meeting, Thomas and everyone. Bye.
Bye.